This feature has been brought to you by Slot Foundation, which needs your support to continue projects like these. Information on this recording and access to other recordings is available online at slot.org.
Well, it's a great pleasure for me to introduce Catherine Yu, who is not only a very good friend, but a brilliant writer and a very versatile critic who dominates a number of fields that is quite amazing. Art criticism, French classical literature, literary theory, creative writing, cultural studies, Lacanian theory. And I'd say simply, not to be too long there, that Catherine is a true author whose intelligence and sense of style are constantly felt in everything she writes. And there is one genre, I think that's the genre she distinguished herself first, that I think she's absolutely wonderful in, which is the short art criticism essay, or the catalogue introduction. I think she's written something like 300 pieces in that genre, and they are all short, they all have punch, they all have a sort of morality. I just quote a little at random. Jean-Michel Basquiat is the black child man enacting Arthur's fantasies about Van Gogh. Beverly Sims denounces the fetishization of the female body. Man's photographs sever the eye from the gaze, and so on. Her first book, her first critical book, is called Copying Machines, and it's a fast-paced, groundbreaking discussion of the state of theory in the U.S. today, plus an exploration of a longer line of questions linking French classicism, Rousseau's paranoid romanticism, Derrida's and de Man's self-consciously referential circumfessions. I think in this book, Catherine has managed to change our view of classical French literature, and she has, for instance, re-examined canonical texts like The Princesse de Clèves, Don Juan, Molière, Rousseau's Confessions. Her first novel, I have it here, and I think it's broad enough to stand on its own, Oriental Girls Desire Romance, is a partly autobiographical novel that is not devoid of theory. In a 1995 essay devoted to the question of revolutionary culture, Catherine explains how the genre of the autobiographical essay imposed itself on her. And she documents in this essay how her parents' brief but intense engagement with Maoism led her to become wary of any fascination for a master, even when this master is adorned with all the seductive gear of revolutionary fervor, even when the master wants to create a new world, a new identity. A similar analysis recurs in the novel, and reading the essay and the novel side by side, it becomes clear that Catherine critiques politics of identity, and that so many essays in her canon have been denouncing this in one way or another. And I think a second novel called The Suicide of an Assistant Professor is to be is to be published by the other press in 2003. Catherine is a very prolific writer. I haven't counted how many essays she's written. There is a consistent agenda that runs through much of her writing. And for instance, in a number of essays published in Lacanian Ink, she already touches on the theme of our talk today, that is Lacan and popular culture. Lacan belongs to popular culture, and he is comparable to the serial Maos or Marilyns produced by Warhol. Both Lacan and Maro initiated, according to Catherine, dangerous leaps forward into a new awareness of the truth of our desires. This has led Catherine to systematize, and something that she's written a lot about, but hadn't been collected yet, I think, the links between psychoanalysis and conspiracy theory. Freud famously declared that he had succeeded where the paranoiac had failed. Lacan wanted to succeed where Freud had failed, and Warhol meant to succeed no matter what, preferably in the American capitalist system. As we will see, although highly successful, Catherine is not obsessed by success and not impressed by it either. At any rate, she has succeeded in impressing me more than once. Let us welcome her.
Thank you very much, Jean-Michel. I feel like I have to live up to this introduction, the eloquence of this introduction, especially. I'm going to talk about Jacques Lacan and Andy Warhol, and I'm going to show you a clip from Télévision today. I should show you slides of Warhol's paintings, but I feel as if in my sort of literary, with my literary hat on, that the description should suffice, and that visual aids are often prostheses for thinking. Jacques Lacan is a thinker and clinician whose apprehension of recording and broadcast media allows him to live on posthumously with a pop star status he gained in post-war Parisian intellectual life. He is not only a serious rival to the official heirs of Freud, but has emerged as a rival of that other superstar, Jean-Paul Sartre. The history of his exclusion or excommunication from the IPA, International Psychoanalytic Association, and his subsequent notoriety is crucial for the theorization of his reception in Anglophone academia. There is an aura of transgression or the smell of sulfur surrounding the sovereignty of his actions and thinking. His insistence on the signifier is key to an undoing of the humanist hermeneutics that swaddled more orthodox receptions of Freud. In addition, Lacan's interest in cybernetics seems to anticipate the plague of questions raised by technological progress. The reactions to his deviation from psychoanalytic orthodoxies revealed the religious fervor with which the guardians of Freudianism try to protect their territory. Today, Lacan's work continues to teach us lessons, not only about psychoanalysis, but about media and history as well. Playing the master of the airwaves allowed Lacan to perform as both charlatan and master. Consider his performance in Télévision. His analytic attitude seemed like a posture of pure provocation to his more conservative colleagues. In his pedagogical performances, Lacan demonstrated that all forms of intersubjectivity, whether mediated by transference or other forms of telecommunication, is based upon a bewitching mirage of reciprocity or mutual understanding. Using the insights of structuralist linguistics and anthropology as the conditions for thinking through the question of la parole, Lacan often stated the obvious. To speak is first of all to speak to others. In so doing, however, he emphasized the primary status of linguistic materials and revealed the limitations of approaches that neglect it. Explaining Lacan is not my intention here. I am not so bold to go where others have not feared to tread. First of all, Lawrence Rickles has taught us that the process of explanation involves the melancholic incorporation of a sovereign discourse that ends up digesting and doing violence to the unassimilable text by pre-chewing it for easier consumption. This seems to be the fate of a lot of Lacan's work. Because of its difficulty, there are endless introductions to Lacan, essays about explaining Lacan. Secondly, Lacan's mapping of the four discourses of the master, university, hysteric, and analyst invites the work of explanation to take up the discourse of the university. This discourse is the place where all forms of complexity and ambiguity, today called otherness among other names, are mapped onto the field of knowledge. The discourse of the university reproduces as a pale, domesticated double of the uncanniness of the heterogeneous and the radically diverse. Michel de Certeau pointed the way out of this impasse and towards a historiography that, in its attentiveness to writing and history, demonstrates that it is possible to deal psychoanalytically with unruly subjects of study without wrestling them into submission in order to fulfill the institutional order of the day. It is his work that opened the path for what follows. Warhol's Lacan. The constellation of Jacques Lacan and Andy Warhol demands theorization. It seems that their paths never crossed, but the empirical non-encounter might give way to a conceptual intimacy that has yet to be excavated. While Lacan emerged as an intellectual apostate in the field of psychoanalysis who struggled against the truisms of ego psychology, Warhol gained notoriety through his photo silkscreen works that functioned as a seductive polemic against the notions of authenticity and the trace of the artist's hand and gesture. Both Lacan and Warhol were masters of image control, and they did affirm, albeit in very different ways, the radically mediated quality of intersubjectivity, while refusing to concede a space of positive political activity. Initiating a negative dialectics with regard to critical thinking that was both the subversion of and the radicalization of the Frankfurt School's engagement with mass culture. They attacked a modernist utopia that was based, in Lacan's case, on the therapeutic ego-psychological readings of Freud, and in Warhol's case, on the institutionalization of abstract expressionism as high art. Is it mere coincidence, then, that for both Jacques Lacan and Andy Warhol, 1964 proved to be an enormously significant year? In 1964, Lacan gave his first seminar after his official banishment from the Société Française de la Psychanalyse, the SPF, and the French arm of the IPA. And the first seminar that he gave was the four fundamental concepts of psychoanalysis, often the only Lacanian text that's cited in many American texts that we'll talk about later. 1964 was also the same year that Andy Warhol had his first one-person show in New York City at the Leo Castelli Gallery, launching a career as an artist who brought popular culture into the making of fine art by affirming the saturation of the visual field with a lapidary iconography of the commodity and imitating the techniques of mass production. Marcel Duchamp, with his ready-mades, had hailed the importance of the mass-produced object for contemporary art production, but he was mostly ignored by the painters of the New York School. Warhol took Duchamp's lessons further. Lacan took issue with the IPA's emphasis on adaptation to the conditions of post-war existence that were increasingly streamlined according to a society of consumption, or life, American style. It would seem, then, as if Lacan and Warhol should be at loggerheads, for one seems to refuse the happiness promised by American consumerist versions of therapeutic psychoanalysis, while the latter seems to produce an art that was ready-made for consumer culture. Benjamin Buchlow argues for the rigor of Warhol's polemical position against the elitism of the high modernist abstraction. Buchlow demonstrates that Warhol was able to overcome the compromise formations in the work of Robert Rauschenberg and Jasper Johns, whose collage technique and citations of commodity culture appear coy and precious next to Warhol's all-out affirmation of the mass-produced image's invasion of the picture field. And we cannot separate Warhol's productivity from the factory, which provided unique working conditions that he fully exploited. He told collectors outright that he did not make many of his paintings. He is supposed to have bought the idea of the Campbell soup painting from a willing seller. He testifies enthusiastically to his admiration for the creativity and energy of others and speaks of himself as someone barely able to keep up with his dynamic cohorts. I quote, "I suppose I have a really loose interpretation of work, because I think that being alive is so much work at something you don't always want to do. Being born is like being kidnapped," end quote. But where others found a magical process of art making in action, Warhol saw himself as being on the job. Quote, "Why do people think artists are special? It's just another job." The factory was comprised of a group of ardent fans and followers who understood on some level that in attacking the foundations of high art, Andy was going to give the motley crew of aspiring rock stars from Long Island, the drug-addled heiresses, the petit bourgeois drag queens, and frustrated butch dykes access to an enclave of artistic production that had hitherto included only straight, white, and sometimes closeted males. The notion of alternative access that Lacan offered was somewhat different. He offered his followers a reading of Freud that was punctuated by the advent of the signifier, and in so doing, liberated psychoanalysis from the burden of an ossified orthodoxy based upon the normative constrictions of ego psychology and its emphasis on connectedness, healthy and appropriate relationships, etc. Lacan and Warhol both affirm a subject whose submission to the laws of repetition renders its relationship to the sign as both letter and icon inexorable. Under the aegis of the commodity, the barge subjects of Lacanian psychoanalysis and contemporary art face down the conditions of desire in the field of the signifier. An alternative psychoanalytic movement crystallized around Lacan's person and work, which bore the indelible imprint of his defiance and charisma. Before Sherry Turkle studied forms of life online, she undertook an investigation of the culture of French psychoanalysis during the 70s and 80s. Turkle concludes that Lacan's emergence as the cult hero of a dissident movement spurred the dissemination of a culture of psychoanalysis in French culture in general. Her definition of popular culture may be a bit vague. Interviews with people from all walks of life seem to suffice as her raw material, and a sampling of newspaper coverage stands in for her work on mass media. She was, nevertheless, an important witness to the passionate conflicts and intense debates that raged in the Lacanian movement. Her account of the psychoanalytic civil wars is corroborated by Elizabeth Rudinesco's work on the history of psychoanalysis in France. Under the star of Lacan, an enormous amount of work was accomplished. Scandals ignited, passions inflamed, careers made and destroyed, people turned on and off. A transferential space of productivity crystallized around his person, and this ambience inspired both madness and work. Critical resistors. Benjamin Buchlow concludes that the political significance of Warhol's work must be grasped in an allegorically negative manner. Before the work of the pop master, the viewer of contemporary art can no longer deceive herself about the flimsy firewall between art and commerce. Warhol consigns the viewer to the tragic fate of the consumer. I quote Buchlow. Warhol has unified within his constructs both the entrepreneurial worldview of the late 20th century and the phlegmatic vision of the victims of that world, that of the consumers. The ruthless diffidence and strategically calculated air of detachment of the first, allowed to continue without ever being challenged in terms of its responsibility, combines with that of its opposites, the consumers, who can celebrate in Warhol's work their proper status of having been erased as subjects. Regulated as they are by the eternally repetitive gestures of alienated production and consumption, they are barred, as are Warhol's paintings, from access to a dimension of critical resistance. End quote. Warhol understood the conditions of contemporary art to be barred from critical resistance, and in affirming such a limit, he confronts the situation rather than shrinking from the contemporary conditions of art production. To understand Warhol's political importance as an artist, we must grasp his asceticism with regard to the possibility of positive political act. The uncannily affirmative attitude, however, towards mass culture on the one hand and repetition and chance on the other, allow him to vacate artistic intentionality with the rigor of Cage while going beyond him at the same time. In his mobilization of indifference and contingency, Warhol's hypnotized gaze was tooled at the firmament of the mass-produced and degraded images whose tarnished aura he reproduced and celebrated. In Liz Coates' reading of his A Novel, she emphasizes that the publication of a transcription of conversations with factory superstar Ondine deploys the ready-made principle of art-making that Duchamp had put into place earlier in the 20th century. According to Coates, A Novel captures the continuous streaming of language and the consistency of babble, ambiguity, and nonsense that characterizes oral communication. The literary establishment rejected Warhol's novel as refusing to acknowledge that the conceptual mechanism of a Duchamp, a Cage, or an An Kawara might have an effect on the ideal of literary production as a heroic enterprise. Therefore, Warhol's work in general, but especially his literary work, is not apolitical in a simple way. By focusing exclusively on a process of painting that attacked the notions of creativity and originality, Warhol undermined the popular idealization of artistic production. Therefore, his work and the way in which it is made launches a campaign of destruction against any idealization of creativity or intentionality. By refusing to edit the transcriptions of endless conversations he had with a speed-addled Ondine, he allowed the tape recorder and the transcriber to leave their mark on a work of literature whose radical openness to the accident, the slip-up, the typo, and the lapse of attention is predicated upon the indifference of a time-based medium, electromagnetic tape. He allowed tape recording and its translation or transcription into text to have the final word in a process that he did not hesitate to call writing. A Novel is therefore an anti-novel, and it is a novel that aims at destroying lyricism by using low-tech gadgets to take James Joyce's stream of consciousness aesthetic literally. Lacan and his lessons can be understood as political, precisely because he too maintained a dandy's indifference, not unlike Warhol's phlegmatic vision and imperturbability before the events of May 1968. In Radiophonie, Lacan elaborates upon his refusal of academic notions of pedagogy and his contempt for the idealization of political activism by recounting the following anecdote. I quote Lacan here. I remember the uneasiness out of which a young man who wanted to be a Marxist and had gotten mixed up with a group of members of the one and only party who had showed up in strength, God only knows why, to my paper on the dialectic of desire and the subversion of the subject in psychoanalysis. I was very nice, because I am always nice, and have mentioned in the écrit the confusion that I felt before the following response from this audience member. He quotes the student. Do you think that you can expect to have any kind of effect from writing just a few letters on the blackboard? It's much stronger in French. It's like somehow my translation makes it a lot longer. Such an exercise, however, had its effects. This is Lacan. And I have the proof. My book, The Écrit, was rejected by the Ford Foundation that supports such gatherings in order to clean them up. The foundation found it unthinkable to publish me. It is just that the effect that is produced has nothing to do with communication of la parole and everything to do with the displacement of discourse. If the Ford Foundation refused to fund the translation of Écrit into English, in contrast, it provided the funds for the translation of Heinz Hartmann's Ego Psychology and the Problem of Adaptation. I'm going to summarize here. Hartmann, of course, is the head of the IPA at the moment of Lacan's excommunication. His arch enemy is funded by the Ford Foundation. And he relates this anecdote in a radio interview. And wired as he was, he understood that radio functions as a superegoic voice. Radio transforms the voice into the oral material that shakes us up from within because it is audible everywhere all at once. Lacan chides the leftist movement for its naivete. The demand for an immediate effect is part of a fantasy of political efficacy and critical resistance. And he is warning his interlocutors that American institutions have an invisible political effect on post-war intellectual life in France, censoring, policing the translation of texts, and that Lacan himself is hardly on the side of power here. With the publication of Francis Stoner Saunders' Cultural Cold War, the CIA and the World of Arts and Letters, we can no longer view the activities of these philanthropic organizations as innocent. The Ford Foundation was engaged institutionally and ideologically with the CIA in the dissemination of an imperialist vision of post-war Europe reformed and restructured under American domination. But Lacan's position was predicated on a double refusal. The first resists the Marxist call to immediate and effective action. The second resists reworking his writing to suit the standards of the foundation. October Revolutions. Rosen Krauss has recently condemned the Lacanian account of subjectivity for its complicity in celebrating and affirming the febrile pleasures of visual and popular culture. Mobilizing Lacan's theorization of identification in relation to the image, Joan Kopczak and Slavoj Žižek have inverted critical theory's relationship to popular culture. Critical theory no longer explains popular culture explains critical theory. Krauss charges that in this kind of cultural and visual studies, there is no possibility of arriving at critical resistance against a consumerist reception of the products of mass media. From Krauss's arguments, what critical resistance might be is unclear, but it is perhaps related to a distaste for the popular that is reflected in the journal October, which becomes the materialist standard against which the work of Lacanians falls short. In a sense, she echoes Lacan's angry student, and her critique can be paraphrased very roughly as, do you think you can have any kind of political effect at all by describing subjectivity as being constituted by an identificatory relationship with the image? Her mode of critique deploys the negativity of the Frankfurt School without, however, mention of Adorno or Horkheimer. She points out that often cultural studies offers nothing more than a mythical recoding of popular culture. But when she tries to offer an alternative to the infernal repetition of consumerism, her lessons become less compelling. She finds cultural and visual studies to be neglectful of historical materialism, and she offers critical resistance as the strategy that will put an end to the madness of repetition, mirroring, and mimesis that shape the relationship between the academic discipline and consumerist culture. Like fetishism, the term resistance does double duty in the line of fire for Marxist and psychoanalytic discourses, playing the uncanny double agent of two entirely different accounts of determinism. Lacan's Four Fundamental Concepts, Seminar 11, offers an account of repetition as automaton that occurs in language as chance, touche. This affirmation of repetition is first and foremost a way in which the Lacanian analyst refuses to promise the attainment of the cure as the end of repetition. In Krauss's critique of cultural studies, however, the history of this academic discipline is all but ignored. Visual studies shaped by Lacanian theory is the stand-in for a discipline that originated in Birmingham, England, shaped by the work of Raymond Williams and Stuart Hall. For Krauss, Lacanian theory and its reception in the United States has no theory either. We shall discuss the consequence of neglecting the latter. The question of the former is outside the scope of this paper. On the one side of a certain political spectrum, it is considered an aberration that the university thinks about psychoanalysis or popular culture at all, because the objects of academic knowledge should be consecrated by a tradition that looks increasingly contingent. From the other side, popular culture's accessibility is opposed to the elitism of academic objects of study. Popular culture offers objects of enigmatic aesthetic value, which, and the traditional cultural critic would like to serve as a guardian or vestal virgin for the consecrated ones. Žižek, however, mines American popular culture for illustrations of the master's thinking, and a method is at work here, and one that demands reflection. Is popular culture the mirror of psychoanalytic theory? For Lawrence Rickles, California's specificity as a philosopheme and hieroglyph of modernity can only be read through psychoanalytic theory. For Žižek, there is no historical marker in place, and even the rather obvious relationship between Hitchcock's Cold War sensibility and Lacan's relationship to Marshall-planned French academia are abjured in the name of pure theory. Krauss concludes that the Lacanians have been conspiring with cultural studies and modernist aesthetics to produce global capitalism's most faithful minions, initiated into the pleasures of the dematerialized image, ready to take their full upright positions as competent and depoliticized consumers. It was never quite clear that psychoanalysis aspired to or was capable of offering a critique of capitalism. Certainly, the very status of critique and criticism should be slightly disturbed by the most radical aspects of the Freudian adventure. Lacan certainly acted more as a Baudelairean agent provocateur during the events of May 1968. But the radicality of his insistence upon a linguistic and structuralist reading of the analytic relationship was often more performed than communicated. And the foment of those years certainly contributed to the risks he took in his pedagogical and analytical experiments. When Lacanian lessons are idealized as lapidary aphorisms, however, we are doomed, like Žižek, to the endless explanation. Now, what I'm going to do is show you a piece of television, which I think was actually broadcast in 1971. And you know, I'm sorry about the dates, which is very shortly after the encounter in May 1968 with the student that he describes in Radiophonie. And I guess there's a sense of, first I want you to think about how the opening credits work, positioning Jacques Lacan as another name for psychoanalysis. And then I want you to observe the way in which the questions are posed, sotto voce, off-screen, as if from nowhere, and that there is a kind of staged spontaneity to his responses because he's pretending not to read, but it becomes apparent that he is reading. All of this aside, I want you to think about how extraordinary this is as an event broadcast on television, on French television. Okay, so my showing this, in a sense, can't replicate, you know, that broadcast, that event, but the archive, and I know that Aaron is archiving all of these things too, is, you know, this disturbing thing that this became a part of. Okay, let's see, now I'm supposed to do something here. Come and press play.
I mean, that original.
TV video once more. Okay. And then we'll go. Okay. It just said Les Editions du Seuil. So maybe he's another name for television too, Jacques Lacan. Those of you who can't see in the back, you'll see Jacques Lacan Psychanalyse.
Je dis toujours la vérité.
penser toute la dire, on n'y arrive pas. La dire toute, c'est impossible matériellement sans les mots qui manquent. C'est même par cet impossible que la vérité touche au réel.
Ici, on est à la télé.
Il n'y a pas de différence entre la télévision et le public devant lequel je parle depuis longtemps, ce qu'on appelle mon séminaire.
Vraiment pas de différence dans les deux cas.
Il s'agit d'un regard.
It was an interesting cut there, right?
Un regard à qui je ne m'adresse dans aucun des deux cas. Mais au nom de quoi ce regard, au nom de quoi je parle, on ne croit pas pour autant que je parle à la cantonade, c'est le cas de le dire. Je parle à ceux qui s'y connaissent au nom idiot. Analystes que je suppose être dans mon assistance.
You know, I just want to point out one, something about television that is revealed there in that moment. He says, I don't speak to the continent, I don't speak to the rabble. And there's no difference between my speaking on television and my speaking in my seminar, because I'm addressing a gaze in the name of which I speak, but which I am speaking before a gaze which I don't address, but in the name of which I speak. And so there's a way, and he goes, I'm only speaking to the people in the know, and I think that that's interesting too, because television as a medium always speaks to the specialist in some way, because everyone can be an expert. And I want you to think about Benjamin's idea of of mass media producing a kind of special, of every man a special, every man can become a specialist. And I think in German it's Jedermann und Fachmann. Every man can have his little specialization. And he says that that happens in the letter to the editor section of the newspapers. And then, because you can all speak, think about how ridiculous it is on NPR, and this is another medium, where they have somebody specialist from somewhere else, and we always take them at their word, like, oh yeah, he or she knows about that. And so that notion of the specialist, he is already addressing in some way, so was he always already on TV? This is a question that I want to ask in some sense. I have more to say about this question of the medium, but we'll talk about that in a second. The sort of explanation school of Lacanianism forecloses on the material support of his lessons and the role that the tape recorder and transcriber have played in preserving his lessons. Krauss pays lip service to the importance of material supports and alludes to cultural changes that are related to electronic media that are now reorganizing vast segments of the global economy, quote unquote. That's her quote. But she ignores the fundamental problem of electromagnetic tape. I mean, this is on TV, this is now a videotape, but all of the seminars were taped, right? For Krauss, cultural studies suffers from a fundamental misunderstanding of visual material. And she sees the emphasis on identification and the mirror stage in psychoanalytically based cultural theory as being continuous with a modernist refusal of textuality in the visual field. This visual turn and cultural revolution it promises are symptoms for Krauss of the Academy's participation in the production of, quote, freshly wrought imaginary spaces in which subjects of the new cultural and social order might narratively and phantasmatically project themselves. Krauss implicitly accuses Zizek, Kopchak, and Norman Bryson of misreading Lacan because they privilege the realm of the imaginary over the realm of the symbolic, and in so doing neglect the signifier, which Krauss describes as foundational for the constitution of the subject. The four fundamental concepts, as I've mentioned, is the place from which most academic Lacanians have derived a theory of subjectivity based upon a specific reading of the gaze. And this work also shapes Krauss's reading of Lacan. It is impossible to decide, however, who is right and who is wrong here, but it is more important to grasp that in accusing the Foucauldian and Althusserian Lacanians of misunderstanding material supports, Krauss ignores the omnipresent tape recorder and the transcription as the material supports upon which Lacan's teaching is based. For fear of belaboring the obvious, I must insist that the seminars are no more and no less than the reconstitution of taped transcripts and lecture notes. Thus, what is important here is a continued displacement of the question of material support itself. The pseudo-contradiction between image and signifier defers the very question of transmissibility and comprehensibility. What Krauss fights for is the right to be more correct than her rivals, but she misses the support of the material support of Lacan's work, and so cannot deal with the effects of such a support on the reception of his teaching. Just as Warhol's novel was apprehended by the literary establishment as nothing more than gibberish, so have the enigmatic transcriptions of Lacan's seminars been received by his most fervent followers as enigmatic koans of a psychoanalytic Zen master. In fact, recently a colleague of mine told me that he had been thinking about one sentence of Lacan for 15 years. And I thought, what have I been thinking about for 15 years? Where to get my hair cut, you know, occasionally. This has been on my mind a lot for 15 years. And so this kind of Talmudic relationship to a text that is actually not writing in the strictest sense of the word, in terms of a Derridean sense of question of writing the inscription or something like that, because the inscription, in fact, perhaps was Lacan's notes, but have been translated into his oral performance, translated into the tape recorder, then retranscribed by a transcriptionist, fingers into type text that are then revised and published. Right. So it is not my goal here to decide whether or not transcriptions merely communicate nonsense or surplus wisdom. What I would like to point out is that blah, blah, blah and a sage's parables may not be that far apart when they persist in the residue of tape recording. The other material condition of support that Krauss misses out on is the emergence of an underground or alternative psychoanalytic milieu with a charismatic master at its center whose work and personality represent a certain relation of absolute openness to recording media. As Friedrich Kittler has shown, the tape recorder was on all the time. Warhol's factory also offers us good lessons in understanding repetition, transferential space, time warping, and acting out. In founding his own school, Lacan saw talented people gravitate into his sphere of influence, ready to work under his tutelage, inspired by his teaching. In Warhol's case, the factory's denizens were inspired by Warhol's negative charisma and his uncanny ability to aid and abet them in the making of themselves the very material of his work. Lacan's inspiration functioned in the same way because of an ethical position that he took with regard to the International Psychoanalytic Association on the one hand and the language of psychoanalysis on the other. Warhol's ethical position with regard to originality and repetition implies, as we have shown, a certain asceticism. His ethical position is certainly at odds with a moral one. He was not interested in being good or even in being a good artist, and it often seemed at the end of his life that he was much more interested in success, fame, and money than anything else. Therefore, he was ethically consistent. He espoused an admiration for business art and never allowed himself to pretend that he was not just working. His refusal of the magic originality of the artist and the aura of artistic production was both frightening and liberating. For Gérard Pommier, Lacan's ethical position also allowed for an explosion of productivity around him. Quote, after the war and the Berlin Association's blindness towards or compromises with Nazism, psychoanalysis can gain ground in lost in Germany only with great difficulty. On the other hand, Lacan's ethical position was enough to produce a significant expansion of psychoanalysis in France. Ethics, evokes Socrates, inspires courage, and more simply, the strength that certain men have had always to stand up to imposture. Pommier is referring to Lacan's confrontation with the ego-psychological impostors who gathered around Freud's empty place after his death and the formation of the IPA. Instead of mourning Freud, Hartmann and company filled in the void with the image of his daughter, Anna Freud, whose egosyntonic take on psychotherapy shaped the agenda of Freudian associations that wanted her support. In the context of the anecdote from Radiophonie, we can also apprehend Lacan's ethics as having something to do with his refusal to idealize immediacy in the political sphere. The live performance of Lacan's seminars was captured and preserved obsessively. Friedrich Hitler has identified sound as the medium of the real. The portable sound technology of sound recording is what has made possible the very dissemination of the Lacanian lessons. You could think of them as being in conspiracy with tape recording. And after the early 60s, when portable tape recorders were made available on a consumerist level in Europe and here in the United States, I think in the United States it was Magnavox and RCA that produced the first portable tape recorders. In Europe, it was Philips and Siemens. You can imagine there were many bootleg tapes of Lacan's seminars. And so in some ways, Lacan is always already wired to technology and its possibilities. Hitler reminds us that the seminar was formed by Lacan's relationship to amplification and the recording of his voice. Quote, I quote Hitler now, only tape heads are capable of inscribing into the reel a speech that passes over understanding heads. And all of Lacan's seminars were spoken via microphone onto tape. Lowlier hands need only then play it back and listen in order to be able to create a media link between tape recorder, headphones, and typewriter, reporting to the master what he has already said. His words barely spoken lay before him in typescript, punctually before the beginning of the next seminar. Lacan's feedback loop then was plugged into various low-tech media, and the spontaneity and obscurity of his speech was guaranteed by the transcription that was made for his eyes only. His audience had to be all ears, or else smuggle in tape recorders of their own, which was more and more possible as reel-to-reel gave way to the portable cassette deck favored by Warhol in 1964 as the instrument with which he would write a novel which he celebrated. Quote, Warhol, I did my first tape recording in 1964. I think it all started because I was trying to do a book. A friend had written me a note saying that everybody we knew was writing a book, so that made me want to keep up and do one too. So I bought that tape recorder and I taped the most interesting person I knew at the time, Ondine, for a whole day. Gadget lovers both, Lacan and Warhol, understood that writing and speaking had been permanently transformed by the technological advances in recording media. For a while, Rosalind Krauss in October magazine accepted that the Žižekian version of Lacanian theory overcame certain impasses reached by ideologie critique. But in her 1966 condemnation of Lacanianism, she concludes. She puts Lacanianism with, aligns with Lacanianism with cultural studies. Cultural studies doesn't necessarily accept Lacan. Right? We all know that. Anyway. I'll go on. Cultural studies has always proclaimed itself as revolutionary, the avant-garde operating within the academy, as an insurgency in the wake of the events of May 1968. Visual studies has had very little to do to map itself onto the cultural studies model, since, as I have tried to suggest, that earlier model was already thoroughly dependent upon a certain non-materialist conception of the image. The image is fundamentally disembodied and phantasmatic. But whether this revolution is indeed an insurgency or whether it, as an unexceptional case of cultural revolution, serves an ever more technologized structure and helps acclimate subjects of that knowledge to increasingly alienated conditions of experience, both of them requirements of global capital, is a question we must continue to ask. My argument here is that contemporary subjects need very little help from cultural studies to acclimate themselves to the strange weather of increasing alienation. In addition, technologized structure remains an unexamined evil in this version of the present political situation. If Krauss's argument seems to fall apart here, it is precisely because it falls into a non-dialectical dogmatism that Žižek himself, along with Frederick Jameson, have identified as the constitutive limit of Theodor Adorno's work, where in trying to break through the Hegelian self-transparency of the notion, Adorno remained thoroughly Hegelian. In her recourse to social conditions and materialism, Krauss invokes these terms like a magical incantation that implies that there is a form of resistant critique that can work against the adaptation of subjects to technology and in so doing struggle against global capitalism itself. It is self-evident in her argument that technology is a handmaiden of alienation and capitalism. thinkers such as Hitler and Žižek were able to address and play with vulgar materialism and its limits, and it is no coincidence that both were educated in the former Soviet bloc and that their disillusionment with materialist accounts of critical resistance and social conditions acted as an inspiration for them to overcome the impasses presented by leftist critique. It is one of the ironies of the end of the Cold War, and certainly a sign of American victory, that it is the American who serves up a lesson in Marxism and revolution to the former citizens of the Soviet bloc. Žižek performs a compelling analysis of representational democracy by demonstrating the unbearable abstraction of equality for subjects of such a state. He insists that the persistence of an irrational desire for a strong patriarchal figure in certain emerging nation states cannot be conjured away by the Enlightenment's magic wand, and criticized the generalized application of a Western European political model for countries that could not bear the weakness of the executive branch. Borrowing a page from Carl Schmitt and emphasizing Lacan's reading of Hegel's master-slave dialectic, Žižek was able to advocate a therapeutically correct form of constitutional monarchy for the emerging democracies of the world. For Kittler, however, the states of emergency and states of exception evoked by wartime produced the greatest leaps in technological innovation, and the technical media themselves are mapped onto the Lacanian schema of symbolic imaginary real. The typewriter for Kittler is the medium of the symbolic, with its variation, with its, you know, black-white variation, film the medium of the imaginary, and sound recording the medium of the real. And it seems as if actually that we get stuck in the first two, typewriter and film, and the sound and the real is actually what's being neglected here. Great leaps forward in technological progress are based upon a wartime psychology of shortages and extreme measures. From telegraph to radar, sonar, rocket technologies, and the internet, a byproduct of the Cold War, Kittler shows that innovation always takes place under duress. He underlines what Žižek, Krauss, and cultural studies miss when they intellectualize mass media and popular culture by making it the bone of academic contention. Quote, I quote Kittler here, "Technical media have neither to do with intellectuals nor with mass culture. They are the strategies of the real. Storage media were built for the trenches of World War I, transmission media for the lightning strikes of World War II, universal computing media for the SDI." And he wrote this under Reagan. Now SDI is coming back again, right? "Chute d'un désastre obscur," as Mallarmé would have put it, "fallen from an obscure disaster." Or, as General Curtis D. Schleyer put it in his introduction to electronic warfare, it is a universally accepted military principle that victory in every future war will be on the side which can best control the electromagnetic spectrum. End quote. Star quality. The very possibility of teaching critical resistance seems to rest upon a notion of communication that Lacan seeks to undermine. Lacan has formulated most forcefully the ways in which, quote, "disinterested communication is ultimately only failed testimony. That is something upon which everyone has already agreed," unquote. The difficulty of Lacanian formulations lends itself to a certain kind of obsessional explication, whether it be through endless introductions or brilliant demonstrations that scan the multifarious narratives and images of popular culture for the example and the illustration that will unlock the enigmatic formulations of the master. I'm going to skip this part of it. Žižek's account of transference and intersubjectivity as derived from Hitchcock films and the logic of how we effectively become something that by pretending that we are already that. To grasp the dialectic of this movement, we have to take into account the crucial fact that this outside is never simply a mask we wear in public, but is rather the symbolic order itself. The affirmation of masks and superficiality in all its forms is a direct attack on high modernist notions of aesthetic sublimity in both gesture and representation. In an interview with Gretchen Berg, Warhol said, quote, "If you want to know all about Andy Warhol, just look at the surface of my paintings and films and me, and there I am. There's nothing behind it." Lacan also launched an attack on the notion of authenticity and intersubjectivity, and the beginnings of the work on the gaze would lead him to theorize the superficiality of the subject in terms of topography. The surface, skin, or inscriptional support for the signifier became a liminal space of difference and differentiation upon which the signifier can make itself legible. Topography and the matheme became the enigmatic formulae of a subjectivity without depth. He, like Warhol, attracted to his person a group of followers who would represent the Lacanian movement, a dissident form of psychoanalysis that would be called the École Freudienne. In Žižekian terms, the byproduct of Warhol's flatness would become the transferential field of magical attraction, or objet petit a. Both Krauss and Žižek seem to understand Lacan, albeit for very different reasons. Krauss's rehearsal of the Lacanian gaze theory goes off without a hitch, and if one rereads the actual seminars on the gaze, things become much more ambiguous. Žižek's famous rhetorical move often begins with, "Is it not obvious that?" seducing us with an example taken from everyday life in juxtaposition with some Lacanian paradox. For Lacan himself, ambiguity is a condition of language. Jean-Michel Rabaté has shown that this is one of the reasons why Lacan favored literature as a way of thinking through and resolving difficult problems. We can also recognize that transcription captures the spontaneity of the improvised and extemporaneous in a pedagogical performance, and often the process of decontextualization itself provides Lacan's pronouncements with an aura of enigmatic complexity. Recently, I was reading The Psychosis, and there's a passage in there where Lacan is talking about a Chinese character for the word illness. You find this very easily. But there's no reproduction of the actual character that he wrote on the board. So my Chinese is not good enough to figure out from the description what the character is. So I sent I have a Chinese graduate student. I asked her, we had this whole big discussion. And it was very productive. But the thing is that this transcript then completely suppresses that level of the seminar, right, which is the blackboard, the interaction between the blackboard and the performance. And I think it's very effective because if you're just reading it, you don't have to not know Chinese to feel completely lost. And so there's a level at which the seminars themselves are an occultation on the level of the real, of the very teachings of Lacan himself. Anyway. The confusion of words, the unaccountability of certain turns of phrase, make understanding what one says very difficult. Lacan shows in Seminar 3, The Psychoses, that the précieux of the 17th century tried to refine a language of the salons that would be a mark of their elite status, but certain expressions that they innovated, such as le mot me manque, have passed into everyday contemporary French. Le mot me manque, the word is missing to me, I don't have words for this, there are no words for this, but put in a rather precious way. And he actually uses a formulation like that in the beginning of Télévision. I can't tell the whole truth because the words are missing. Okay, or the words are lacking, something like that. He then goes on to talk about how much confusion there is about words and their meanings. This takes place in the context of a discussion of Schreber's memoirs and Freud's reading of them. The psychotic slippery relationship to meaning and complexity is shown to be on a continuum with the confusions of everyday usage. Actually, you know what I would have to say here? I would have to revise myself here and say that the psychotic may have a slippery relationship to language, but he experiences his relationship to language with absolute certainty, or to meaning with absolute certainty. I'm going to quote Lacan here. If I were to ask each of you one by one what you understood by the word superstition, for example, I am sure that we would arrive at the lovely idea of the confusion that can occur in your mind with regard to a word that you are using a great deal of lately. After a certain point, the word superstructure would appear. Epiphenomena have a very special meaning in medicine. Linnaeus calls epiphenomena the phenomena such as fever that are shared by all illnesses. The origin of the word superstition is given by Cicero in his De Natura Deorum, that it would do you good to read. The supersticiosi were people who prayed and made sacrifices all day long so that their descendants would survive them. Superstition is the tenacious devotion of people to a goal that appears to them essential. Kristen Ross has pointed to the French denial of its complicity with colonial conflict after the Algerian War, and has added a new dimension to our understanding of the post-war French situation. However, her condemnation of certain intellectual positions does not take into account the fact that responding to a historical situation often takes place in a deferred manner. In 1957, the year of the Psychoses Seminar, the year of the Battle of Algiers, Lacan was working on the testimony of a man who suffered a psychotic break with reality. He's working on the Schreber case. Schreber's autobiography is the testimony of someone who has lost his relationship to meaningful communication. After weeks of being unable to sleep, he gives into the fantasy that he is being transformed into a woman so that he can have sex with God and thereby prevent the destruction of the world. Lacan was indeed talking about war in the seminar on psychoses. It was the intra-subjective conflict of the psychotic, however, and it had everything to do with securing the boundaries of one's identity. Lacan was talking about war, but it was just not the kind of war that Ross would have recognized. The difficulty of Lacan is legendary, but the obscurity of his language acquired a radiance all his own. Claude Lévi-Strauss reminisces about attending Lacan's first seminar in 1964 at the École Normale Supérieure. What was striking was a kind of radiant influence emanating from both Lacan's physical person and from his diction, his gestures. I've seen quite a few shamans functioning in exotic societies, and I rediscovered their kind of equivalent of the shaman's power. I confess that as far as what I heard went, I didn't understand a thing. I found myself in the middle of an audience that seemed to understand, however. The magic that Zizek describes to Objet Petit Da is obviously what is produced by Lacan himself. Understanding the difficulty of the master is the magic that the master creates for his most devoted interlocutors and followers. According to Zizek, the Lacanian name for this byproduct of our activity is Objet Petit Da, the hidden treasure, that which is in us more than ourselves, that elusive, unattainable X that confers upon all our deeds an order of magic, although it can never be pinned down to any of our positive qualities. The subject can never fully dominate and manipulate the way he provokes transference in others. There is always something magic about it. This magic that is beyond our grasp is also one of the material conditions of Lacan's aura. For if Lévi-Strauss testified to his incomprehension, he also saw that his fellow audience members were captured by incomprehensibility and seemed to understand and stand in the auratic circle. Both Lacan and Warhol put into practice, at least for a time, a kind of radical affirmation and permissiveness with regard to people. Who, because of their growing notoriety, were more and more attracted to their persons. There are many early accounts of the factory, but Kynaston McShine's is perhaps the most succinct. Quote, in addition to serving as a studio, the factory became Warhol's own Hollywood set, and the maestro found himself surrounded by a coterie of acquaintances, jeunesse, some doré, some tarnished, glamorous transvestites, eager dealers, avid collectors, avant-garde matrons in New York society, prescient young curators, precocious pets, and the cunning curious. This cast became the subject of his films. Surrounded by the beautiful people and intrigued by his own drawing power, Warhol regarded himself as director and impresario both within and outside the factory, with the power to invent superstars. In Rudinesco's description of Lacan's cabinet following the founding of his school, the EFP, we can see a peculiar similarity between the two scenes. The door at the Rue de Lille was open to anyone and without appointment, to members and non-members, to analysants and the sick, to robbers, thugs, psychotics, and the troubled. In sum, anyone could show up at his home to discuss absolutely anything. Very early on, Lacan contracted the habit of no longer giving appointments at fixed times. He was unable to refuse anyone, and anyone could come to his sessions according to his whim or need. The doctor's house was an immense asylum in which one could move about freely, its doors open from morning to night among first editions, artistic masterpieces, and piles of manuscripts. The chaos of their semi-public, semi-private spaces of work and speculation is predicated on the question of the experiment. For Lacan, as for Warhol, the question of the unpredictable became a factor of everyday life and everyday work. Age and a confrontation with mortality would decrease their openness, but in the early 60s, the anti-institutionality of their work sites presents a utopic ideal of work that was more speculative than practical. Friedrich Kittler highlights Lacan's relationship to recording devices as a condition of the master's difficulty. What the Lévi-Strauss anecdote reveals is the quality of the listening. Lacan's rapt interlocutors also had an effect upon the master's pronouncements. The listening was hardwired to the magic of Lacanian charisma. That is, Lacan was not only speaking to the tape heads. His performance was a performance for those who bathed in the enjoyment of understanding the incomprehensible. Both Warhol and Lacan were working through ideas about the principles of repetition, albeit in fantastically different spaces. For Lacan, Freud's theories of repetition had to be amplified by an insistence on the signifier. Lacan undoes the everyday notion of communication by showing that this clinic is a space of exchanges that are irreducible to interpretation on the level of meaning alone. This ostensibly modest lesson, unassimilable by mainstream psychoanalysts in America, has shaped certain areas of literary and cultural studies. For Warhol, painting became a space where low-tech strategies of repetition, such as silk screening, would replace the authenticating gesture of the artist's hand. Shortly after his success, the success of his first one-man show in New York, Warhol retired from painting. Both Lacan and Warhol represent different aspects of a masterful opacity in their relationship to recording devices. One baffles because of the complexity of his recorded speech, the other because of the simplicity of his utterances, often punctuated merely by the word wow. Both, however, understood that a certain detachment with regard to repetition is necessary in the age of mechanical reproduction. The subject of popular culture and mass media is the barred subject of politics. The condition of its powerlessness is transformed by its momentary consecration as an object of knowledge. In pointing to the increasing sophistication of consumption in popular culture and academic discourse, Krauss indicates a problem with cultural and visual studies. But what she misses is the institutional frame of her own arguments. A more correct reading of Lacan makes no difference in the application of his theories if the historiography of Lacanian reception is neglected. In any case, the legacy of Lacan continues to provoke thought and debate, and his lessons and career can be analyzed in terms of the allegorical missed encounter with his contemporary Andy Warhol. The Frankfurt School took the criticism of enjoyment to its very limit by demonstrating that mass culture offered a miniaturized outlet for libidinal release. Fun becomes the name of the diminished pleasures that are offered to us. Along with fun comes an innervated political sphere. Criticism is a word related to crisis. The saturation of the visual field with mass-produced images and the technologization of the archives have both led to a crisis in the university itself. Cultural studies tries to make studying more fun by offering easy transgressions of disciplinary and institutional boundaries. Is this perhaps its fatal error? If it is, Krauss's corrective seems no more effective at addressing the critical situation in which we find ourselves. She wants to be more correct than her colleagues, whom she denounces as having offered a false promise of revolution. In so doing, she plays her superegoic role with gusto and acts as the fierce guardian of a political orthodoxy whose territoriality can only subsist and persist within the confines of the university. How can we renounce such Pyrrhic victories in order to produce, to promote a more experimental, a more generous kind of thinking and engagement with history, theory, and aesthetic production? Lacan taught that the discourse of the university is indeed doomed to slavishness, which, as we know, has its own pleasures. Thank you.
The
goal. As the one who's sort of heroically making a last stand.
Resisting a number of controversies and asserting independence and creating a movement. And is this something that is completely... Because you were contextualizing.
Yeah. I mean, this kind of Gaullism that is promoting a kind of an implicit anti-Americanism, anti-imperialism, while at the same time installing itself as a kind of counter-imperial project that is hegemonic in its counter-hegemony. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I think all of those contradictions come home to roost at the end of his career. But this is a moment when he's in full flower in some way. Yeah. Between the Eastern Bloc and the American influence and the Marshall Plan, you know, France makes its last stand. It's an allegorical. So there's a kind of allegorical negativity maybe that France represents at that point, and that I think that American intellectuals of the 70s and 80s were very, very attracted to, because of certain problems within our own history that we couldn't face up to.
I wanted to share with you something that I think is a little of a paradox that I was thinking of woman in May 68 at the time when Lacan was clearly an intellectual hero, and it made me think of the transmission of Lacan in Latin America. There was he said in 1980 when he went to Venezuela, he was addressing an audience of readers. They learn about Lacan through reading what was transmitted as a text, a transcription of the seminar. And he became, at least as completely the case of Argentina, a pop hero where any cab driver could quote Lacan and make sense of it, and is an icon of popular culture. And a coffee table book in an Argentinian middle class household is a Greek, not a piece or Picasso or Warhol. So I would think it's the paradoxical situation that in the States, it reminds me of the exhibit in the Library of Congress where Freud is reduced to a popular icon comparable to Warhol or JFK, if that's the case, that how this passage through popular culture and how the transmission of Lacanian psychoanalysis, we were mentioning cultural studies as if that is the case of Lacanian psychoanalysis in the States associated with any other feedback, the clinical practice, that how this passage through popular culture in Latin America transforms psychoanalysis into a strong popular but also clinical movement, and what happened here, and how, maybe if you had any thoughts, taking into consideration the French context and the American context in terms of Lacanian popularization or anti-popularization of Lacan.
No, I think you sketched it out very well. I don't know what I can add to it. I'm actually, I'm having l'esprit de l'escalier on the last question. Maybe I'll tie this in. But actually, I think what France represented was a mediation of German modernity for the post-war situation. Germany was that, and German philosophy was that which had to be mobilized as a resource and was fought over by the Soviet Union on one side and America on the other side, and the dissemination of German of German modernity, Heidegger, Freud, Hegel, France was uniquely positioned in a certain way to say, we have the true handle on modernity, and perhaps that links up with your question about this. The strange bypassing of all of this in America, the question of modernity and psychoanalysis aren't aligned in the way they are in Latin America, where modernity becomes popularized through psychoanalysis. You'd think modernity in the United States installed itself almost despite psychoanalysis. But I'm not well informed enough about it, but it's always fascinating to me that's the path that Latin America took in relation to psychoanalysis. That's the truly popular moment. I mean, and this paper is unable to cover that, the popularization of that. But also as a way, I think, of resisting American modernity. Psychoanalysis emerges in Latin America, right, as the form of resistance against a modernity, a monolithic modern notion of modernization that is North American.
I wanted to ask a question about the possibility of escaping the slavishness that you described, precisely in the case of the shaman analogy, because Levi-Strauss actually went out, in addition to making his comments about Constantinople, wrote a piece called The Shaman, The Sorcerer and His Magic, where he compares a kuna sorcery ritual to psychoanalysis, and he what it is the ritual for blocking and or unblocking parturition or the labor process for a woman who's having trouble giving childbirth, and the ritual was sort of transcribed by two Swedes in the early 1903 or something like that. But he makes the analogy on the basis of a sort of comprehensibility that relies on the idea that the psychoanalysis would re-describe reality for the patient, just as the shaman would re-describe reality for the mother who can't succeed at giving childbirth or going through the process of childbirth.
But psychoanalysis doesn't re-describe reality for the patient. The talking cure is absolutely about the patient finding a different relationship to language that is not the product of an active intervention.
Well, I mean, that's part of my question, in a sense, because the way that Levi-Strauss talks about Lacan is different from the way he talks about psychoanalysis when he talks about it in his essay, where he does use that metaphor. But the secondary problem is one that has obsessed Michael Taussig, and is really what I'm getting at. It turns out that the ritual in question uses a secret language which would never have been understood by the woman in question. In other words, a private language that was only known to the initiated shaman within Puna culture. So it seems to me that then the fact that there's a functionality,
But see, that to me would be kind of an inverse relationship to psychoanalysis, because much as people would like to mystify the language of psychoanalysis, the language of psychoanalysis is actually the language of everyday life. The language of the clinic is what happens in the clinic is precisely not an initiatory, like mystical, occulted language. And I think that, you know, I'm very sympathetic to the work of Mick Taussig and Levi-Strauss, one should say this, but I think that the fetishization of magic and shamanism is a reactionary position in modernity par excellence. Something fails in our industrialized modernity. We look to the shaman and magic to allegorize that failure, because we say that there is this magical efficacy. And I really object to this reinstitutionalization or reinscription of these kinds of things as ways out, precisely because they allow for a kind of new Rousseauism, a crypto-Rousseauism about primitivism and naivete that is inspires in me my most ascetic kind of hyper-enlightenment attitude, which is, you know, no, that's pre-modern. You know, there is modern medicine to help women get through labor, and it's absolutely different from the question of the talking cure, because it's the woman who talks, the patient talks, the analysand talks. It's not about a secret language or incantation that moves her into another space or something like that. And I think that is that space. The space of the clinic is a space in which perhaps, you know, rational knowledge becomes deeply disturbed, and that's why we ascribe to it a similarity to magic and shamanism. But it is not a way out. It is definitely not a way out of the impasses of modernity, I think. And it's become a very chic thing, you know, the New Age has brought back all of this stuff. You know, this kind of, Nouveau Buddhism is also seen as a way out, and I just don't think that there's a way out. Anyway.
Maybe it allows for teasing out between all the comparisons that you make between Warhol and Lacan, their politics and their group formations and so on. Maybe discuss a lot of figuring out the difference between them. If you don't think about it, the magic, but maybe the magnetic power and their relation to the magnetic, where Paul puts himself up as the attraction. I'm the secret, invisible thing that can only be recorded by the magnetic field. Whereas Warhol, in this, as he said, negative charisma, doesn't put himself into the limelight, but makes the star and says, she's the star, she's a superstar, he's a star. We'll film him for 24 hours, we'll tape him for 24 hours. It's never himself. It's hardly ever that he's his eyes speak the truth. You know, for him, he just lets the machine talk. Whereas Lacan says, well, the machine talks me. It's a different relationship to the magnetic power that's being harnessed.
It's almost like the empty space of Warhol's creative agency is what produces this kind of special field. But I would say that Lacan empties that space of mastery in a different way. You know, he empties it of the substance of a humanist hermeneutics. You know, for instance, think of Jürgen Habermas, for example. Someone made me think of Habermas in this paper. And that space of communication, he evacuates by performing in this sort of neo-Dadaistic way, teaching.
What would be the difference between your take and Lacan? Say something like the first American popularization by Stuart Schneiderman of the Zen master, to return to this.
How would be my? Well, I mean, maybe it's taken us this long, the second generation of Lacanian readers in the United States to understand that these analogies to the Zen master, to you know this enigmatic teacher, are recourses to that kind of magical religious vocabulary to deal with the radicality of Lacan's negativity. That's what I would say. You know, I've given this paper to a much more Marxist audience, and people have criticized me about my use of material support, so I'm going to criticize myself and then tell you how I responded. They said, you know, material conditions, you're using this in a very difficult way, you're not being Marxist about this. And I said, no, I'm not actually being Marxist about the notion of material conditions, because what Rosen Krauss criticizes in the Lacanians is their ignorance about material support. And so I think she's using material support in a kind of 18th century materialist way. Like literally the material support of the body is what the 18th century materialists were talking about in terms of the body-soul relation. And she's talking about how they ignore art history, the Lacanians. And so I'm just saying, well, there's tape history. There's electromagnetic tape histories. There's a problem with sound recording. And this would get back to what Jean-Michel's first question was, and I will respond to that. And there's new research that I'm doing that's coming out that, in fact, a lot of electromagnetic tape recording was discovered. This is a mythic story. You know, we have to find it confirmed in a bunker in Berlin at the fall of Berlin. There were three units of reel-to-reel tape that were not put together. One of them remained in Berlin, one of them went to New York, and one of them went to Paris. And these became the three centers of synthetic music. And modern music, synthetic sounds. So this kind of dissemination of modernity through magnetic tape happened in this triangular way. And so the dissemination of this technology in a way is what allows for psychoanalysis to take this term in terms of its teachings.